Job 3. The holidays are the crudest time. Croyd had told him one New Year's Eve years ago. Times Square was full of drunks waiting for the ball to come down. Jude had come to observe, and Croyd had hailed him from a doorway. He hadn't recognized the sleeper, but then he seldom did. That time, Croyd had been a head shorter than Jube, his loose, baggy skin covered with fine pink down. He'd had webbed feet and a hip flask of dark rum, and had wanted to talk about his family, about lost friends, about algebra. The holidays are the crudest time, he'd repeated, over and over, until the ball fell and Croyd had puffed himself up like a balloon from the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade and drifted off into the sky.
The crudest time!
He'd shouted down once more, just before he vanished from sight. It wasn't till now that Jube had understood what he'd meant. He'd always enjoyed the human holidays, which afforded such colorful pageants, such lavish displays of greed and generosity, such fascinating customs for study and analysis. This year, as he stood in his newsstand on the morning of the last day of December, he found that the day had lost its savor. The irony was too cruel. All around the city, people were preparing to celebrate the start of what could be the last year of their lives, their civilization, and their species. The newspapers were full of retrospectives on the year just ending, and every one of them had pegged the Swarm War as the year's top story, and every one of them had written it up as if it were all over, except for some mopping up in the Third World. Jubin knew better. He shuffled some newspapers, sold a Playboy, and looked up glumly into a crisp morning sky. Nothing to be seen but a few cirrus clouds, high up and moving fast. Yet she was still there, he knew, far from Earth, moving through the darkness of space, as black and massive as an asteroid. She would blot out the stars as she drifted across them, silent and chill, to all outward appearances cold and dead. How many worlds and races had died believing that lie? Inside, she lived, evolving, her intelligence and sophistication growing daily, her tactics honing themselves with each setback. Among the races of the network, she was the enemy with 100 names, the Demon Seed, the Great Cancer, Hell Mother, Devourer of Worlds, Mother of Nightmares. In the vast minds of the Kandiki God Queens, she was called by a symbol that meant simply dread. The Craig machine intelligences referred to her by a string of binary impulses that signified dysfunction. The Linco Neen sang of her in notes high, shrill, and pain-racked. And the Librar remembered her best of all. To those vastly long-lived cyborgs, she was the Atmahru, darkness for the race. 10,000 years past, a swarm had descended on the Librar birth world. Encased in their life-sustaining shells, the cyborg Librar lived on. But those who had stayed behind to wear flesh instead of metal were gone, and with them all the generations to come. The Librar had been a dead race for 10,000 years.
Mother!
Akedmi had cried out, and Jube had not understood, not until he slit the cord on his stack of newspapers the day the buds landed in New Jersey. It must be some mistake, he had thought inanely when he saw the headlines. The swarm was a horror from history and legend. It was the nightmare that happened to other planets, far distant, not the one you were actually on. It was outside his experience and his expertise. No wonder he had suspected the Takesians when the single ship was lost. He felt as though he was a fool. Worse, he was a doomed and helpless fool. She was up there still, a palpable living darkness that Jube could almost feel. Inside her festered new generations of swarmlings, the life that is death. Soon her children would come again and devour this perversely splendid race that he had come to have such affection for. Devour him, too, for that matter. And what could he do to stop them?
You look like a pot of excrement this morning, walrus.
A voice like sandpaper rasped casually. Jube looked up, and up, and up. Troll was 9 feet tall. He wore a gray uniform over green, warty skin, and when he grinned, crooked yellow teeth stuck out in all directions. A green hand as broad as a manhole cover lifted a copy of the Times delicately between two fingers, nails black and sharp as claws. Behind his custom-made mirror shades, the red eyes sunk beneath his heavy brow ridge, flicked over the columns of newsprint.
"I feel like a pot of excrement," Jube said. "The holidays are the crudest time, Troll. How are things at the clinic?"
"Busy," said Troll. "Tachyon keeps shuttling back and forth to Washington for meetings."
He rattled the times.
"These aliens ruined everybody's Christmas. I always knew that Jersey was just one big yeast infection."
He dug in a pocket, handed Jube a crumpled dollar bill.
"The Pentagon wants to lob a few H-bombs at the mother thing, but they can't find her."
Jube nodded as he made change. He had tried to find the swarm mother himself, using the sensing satellites the network had left in orbit, but without success. She might be hiding behind the moon, or on the other side of the sun, or anywhere in the vastness of space. And if he could not locate her with the technology at his disposal, the humans didn't have a chance.
"Doc won't be able to help them," he told Troll glumly.
"Probably not,"
the other replied. He flipped a half dollar into the air, caught it neatly, and pocketed it.
"Still, you have to try, right? What else can you do but try? Happy New Year, Walrus."
He strode off on legs as thick and gnarled as the trunks of small trees and as long as Jube was tall. Jube watched him go. He was right, he thought, as Troll vanished around the corner. You do have to try. He closed the newsstand early that day and went home. Floating in the cold waters of his tub, awash in dim red light, he considered his options. There was only one, really. The network could save humanity from the Swarm Mother. Of course, there would be a price. The network gives nothing away for free. But Jube was sure that Earth would be only too glad to pay. Even if the master trader demanded rights to Mars, or the moon, or all of the gas giants, what was that weighed against the life of their species? But the opportunity was light years off, and would not return to this system for another 5 or 6 human decades. It must be summoned. The master trader must be informed that a sentient race with enormous profit potential was threatened with extinction, and the tachyon transmitter had been lost with the Embi and the single ship. Jubin must build a replacement. He felt hopelessly unequal to the task. He was a xenologist, not a technician. He used 100 network devices he could not begin to build, repair, or even comprehend. Knowledge was the most precious commodity in the galaxy, the network's only true currency, and each member species guarded its own technological secrets zealously. But every network outpost had a tachyon transmitter. Even primitive worlds like Glabber that could not afford to buy starships of their own. Unless the lesser species had the means to summon the great starships to their scattered, backward worlds, how could trade take place? How could planets be bought and sold? How could profits accrue to the master traders of Starholm? Jube's library consisted of 9 small crystalline rods. One held the collected songs, literature, and erotica of his homeworld. A second, his life work, including all his researches on Earth. The others held knowledge. Surely the plans for a tachyon transmitter would be in there somewhere. Whatever knowledge he assessed would be noted, of course, and its value debited from the value of the researches here on Earth. But surely it was worth it to save a sentient race. There would be expenses, he knew. Even if he found the plans, it was unlikely that he would have the necessary parts. He would have to make do with primitive human electronics, the best he could obtain, and probably he would be forced to cannibalize some of his own equipment. So be it. He had equipment he had never used, the security systems that guarded his apartment, extra locks would do, the liquid metal spacesuit that he could no longer squeeze into, the cold sleep coffin in the back closet, purchased against the contingency of a thermonuclear war during his tenure on Earth, the games machine. There was a more serious problem. He could build a tachyon transmitter, he was sure of it, but how to power it? His fusion cells might be sufficient to punch a beam through to Hoboken, but there were a lot of light years between Hoboken and the stars. Jubin rose from his tub, toweled himself off. He knew much of what would happen when the sleeper went after Akedmi's body. Croyd had told him, a week after that grim afternoon Jubin had spent flushing the remains of his MB brother back to the salt sea from which they had all risen, at least metaphorically. But none of it seemed to matter when the swarmlings landed. Now it mattered. He padded into his living room and opened the bottom drawer of the buffet he'd purchased from Goodwill in 1952. The drawer was full of rocks, green, red, blue, white. Four of the white rocks had bought this building in 1955, even though the old man in the green eyeshade had only paid him half of what the stones were worth. Jube had always used this resource sparingly, since no more stones could be synthesized until the opportunity returned. But the crisis was here. He was no ace. He had no special powers. These would have to be his power. He reached down with a thick, four-fingered hand and grabbed a handful of uncut sapphires. With these, he would locate the MB singularity shifter to power his transmission to the stars. Or, at the very least, he would try.